So when I was in college, we didn't have Facebook yet. We didn't have Twitter, social media, but we did have email. All right, so I'm not that old. We had just started with email. And if you've experienced email, you know that sometimes it can get kind of overwhelming, and your inbox gets flooded, and you get tired of it. And so this happened to one of my good friends in college. And so he decided to be radical. So he sent out an email to everybody he knew, and he said, "I am no longer on email. So this is the last time you'll hear from me. Henceforth, I am shrugging off all electronic communications." And with that, he went dark. And he, out of desperation, he was tired of it. He just said, "You can call me. You can knock on my door. Pass me a note. Whatever. I'm no longer on email."
Couldn't text him.
We didn't have text. People carried cell phones for like emergencies, you know, but not for like normal things.
We could use Morse code.
We could. Or like Telegram or pigeons. Yeah. A lot of options, but smoke messages, email is not one of them. So, who wants to guess how long his dramatic announcement actually held fast?
2 days.
1 hour. 1 hour? Wow. You're really pessimistic. 1 hour. Never mind, guys. I'm back. That was a maybe.
He's still not on email.
What?
He's still not on email.
No, he is on email. Those are the extremes, right? Like, an hour and whatever, how many years that would be? 15, 17 years? A couple weeks, I think. Then he was like, "You know what? This is inconvenient," and he was back. Right. So where else have you seen this type of response? Like, you get tired of something or something gets overwhelming and you just like shrug it off entirely. Have you seen this in other settings or with other issues? The Israelites following God. Interesting. Okay, how so?
They have a cyclical pattern where they're really, really devout about following God, and then they're like, "Oh shoot, let's go build a golden calf."
Oh. Wow. Way to bring us to Exodus. That's good. I was thinking of like candy or something, like something, but that's a great example.
Diets,
all right? What do you mean?
Like, if you commit to not eating.
Okay.
Like a day.
Right? All right. Where else? Juice cleanses. All right. What else?
New Year's resolutions.
New Year's resolutions. Like shrugging off, like what types of things would you.
Yeah, every year it's like, "I'm going to go and exercise." Or,
right.
Be healthy this year.
Right.
Waking up early.
Waking up early, okay. Doesn't pan out for you.
No.
Yeah, so these types of efforts are kind of a common response to something we feel that's not going well. We want something to change, and in order to make some kind of change, we have this tendency to make a drastic, radical change, right? Well, this is a little bit about what Paul addresses in the passage tonight. This is the tendency that the Corinthians were having with regards to sexuality. So we've looked at a couple passages where he challenges them on issues of sexual immorality, dealt with the specific issues of prostitution and of what's essentially incest, and he said, you know, this stuff isn't good. But now he kind of switches gears and he addresses another response that they tend to have, and that's to kind of throw up their hands in general. So he now goes from talking about sexual immorality to talking about sexual morality. What does sex look like? How ought it to be enjoyed, experienced? And so he goes into the topic of marriage. Now, we're going to talk tonight about this passage. We're going to ground it in 1 Corinthians 7. But then we're going to expand a little bit to go outside the passage and think a little bit about marriage in general, to think somewhat about how God designed marriage and get kind of a broad overview there. If we think about sexuality and we think about some of the things that we've been thinking about from last week, the idea that sex is a relational drive, that it's something that is designed for us to connect with somebody else, then My suggestion is that God created our sex desire, created this thing within us in order to push us into relational intimacy with another person, which can be very difficult, can be very complicated, can be extremely fulfilling, but can also be extremely frustrating. And so this desire for sex within us is given to us as a gift to drive us toward intimacy with another person. And of course, that can be perverted and used incorrectly, but that's the purpose. So tonight we're going to talk about how that plays out, talk about what it looks like for a man and a woman in marriage to relate to each other, and then, like I said, kind of broaden our picture a little bit. Well, we're going to look at 1 Corinthians 7. We'll do verses 1 through, I think we're going to go through about 10 tonight, or 5 actually. As we begin this passage, there's an interesting statement. And if you remember, in some of the passages before we've looked at, Paul is quoting stuff that the Corinthians have said. And then he interacts with these mottos or these statements that they take. So that's kind of how it begins as well. And if you ever hear anyone say that the Bible says you shouldn't have sex, then this is the passage you take them to and say, actually, you're wrong. So, 1 Corinthians 7, 1 to 2. Now, concerning the matters about which you wrote, so back up a minute, what book are we in? 1 Corinthians. But apparently, there's a 0 Corinthians, all right? So they actually probably wrote to Paul in response to another letter that he wrote to him. This is one of these kind of biblical mysteries. Paul refers to letters that we've never seen and don't have. So there's probably a letter before this, so they probably had some interchanges before, and they wrote him a letter, and now he's responding to that. About the matters which you wrote, quote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman, end quote. But because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife, and each woman her own husband. All right. True or false? Christians should go on mission trips. True? I hear some equivocating. I hear some possibly. I hear a silly request for rewording. Come on, it's a statement. Is it true or false? What? Okay, some false, true, possibly.
Should is not a good word.
Should is not a good word. You're criticizing my grammar, all right?
That's true, but
must?
It can be right here, too.
Okay. All right, so the point of this is that some statements are true in some situations, not true in others. So, true or false, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. What?
Both.
Okay.
If it's concerning matters that they wrote.
Right. Yes. So here's the issue. The Corinthians have this idea. They're like, all right, you know, you don't want us to have sex with prostitutes. You don't want us to have sex with our father's wives. So, fine. It is good for a man not to have sex, right? Let's just throw it off. That's kind of their attitude, all right? They're saying, it's too complicated. We can't figure it out. We're done. And Paul says, well, you know, those types of efforts don't actually end up working real well, right? New Year's resolutions, diets, shrugging off email for the rest of your life. These types of things aren't actually helpful ways to deal with complicated situations. So he says, actually, no. Because of the temptation to sexual immorality, you should have sex. Each man should have a wife, each woman should have a husband, and you should have sex. That's his suggestion to them. Now, one of the things they're responding to in particular in Corinth is that kind of this Greco-Roman culture that they lived among had a very specific path of life, right? This idea that the Hellenistic family was the cornerstone of society. And if you were a good, I don't know what you would call yourself, Hellene or Greco-Roman or whatever, if you were a good member of society, you would get married and you would have children and you would have your your industry, and you would be a part of this very patristic, a very, very structured, very family-oriented, contributing back to society. You would be part of this, right? And it's all tied up in civic pride, and a lot of the stuff, in some ways, went against worship of the Christian God, because there's a lot of other stuff tied into it. So in some ways, what the Corinthians were responding to was saying, you know, here's this path that we're told we're supposed to go on in our culture, but we're recognizing that that's not really godly. So we just want to abandon it and say, forget it. That's not us. Paul says, no, you don't need to throw it all off. You don't need to cast it aside. There's a different way to handle it. And his response is essentially to say that sex is good, sex is valuable, and that if you want to have sex, you should get married. So he's saying the solution to sexual desire is to get married and to enjoy sex within its proper boundaries. So I do a lot of premarital counseling because I do weddings. It's a really fun thing to do. And sometimes I'll ask couples, well, why do you want to get married? And you know what none of them have ever said to me? Because people just aren't as honest as you would hope they are. But none of them have said, well, you know, we just really want to have sex. But that's probably behind at least some of it. Now, hopefully that's not like the whole reason. But why do you want to get married? Well, you know, sex seems fun. I want to have it. This is the way to do it. I want to get married, right? I mean, that's behind a lot of it. And it ought to be. Paul says, a man should have his wife, a woman should have her husband. This is how it's designed. Part of the problem in our culture is that we have all these alternate ways of handling our sexual desire, so that this drive that I think God has given us to push us into intimate relationship, committed, covenanted relationship with another person, it gets diverted, right? It can get diverted through premarital sex, kind of a ethic that says, well, it doesn't matter. Sex can happen in any context. It doesn't need to be within the covenant of marriage. It can happen through pornography and to say, well, you know, my sexual desire is actually fulfilled through this, and so I'm less driven toward an actual person. It can happen through suppression and through loneliness and through all sorts of things that you can kind of say, all right, I'm going to push this away. And I think sometimes we make that mistake in the church because we tend, you know, it's hard to think in terms of spectrums. And so we think, well, you know, sex can be misused. It can lead to a lot of hurt. So we're just going to downplay it. And if you want to have sex, your job is to try and squash that desire, right? Try and push it away. Try and hold it at bay. And then the problem is, God gave you that desire. And so the trick is, how do you feel that? How do you actually not just bottle that up and try and get rid of it, but at the same time be faithful to the restraints that God's placed on it? And that's the real tricky line of what it looks like to walk in Christian maturity, to embrace your desire, but to say not yet, if you're unmarried. And so that's what Paul says. If you want to have sex, you should get married. And one of the things he's addressing is this idea that has come up that some of the Corinthians were doing. They weren't just abstaining from marriage. They actually had this idea that sex itself was against God. And so they were, some of them, getting married and then abstaining from sex within marriage as a kind of expression of super spirituality. You know, we're going to be married, but we're going to be abstinent throughout our marriage. And Paul says that's just not a good idea. That's not the way God designed it. And I think sometimes we tend to do this. One of the discussion questions I want us to think about in groups, but we'll think about it now first, is what do we tend to elevate as more spiritual, being single or being married? What do you guys think in our culture? Different cultures and subcultures are different, but what do you think?
Married?
Single? Okay.
Eunuchs.
All right. You might live in a different culture than I do, but that's good.
Culture,
single, church, married. Okay, interesting.
That depends. I mean, you could be 50 and single.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think culture really.
Yeah, that's different than being like 20s.
Okay, so there's a window. So it kind of moves, right? Which, where you're supposed to be, right?
Unless you're a nun or a priest.
Unless you're a nun or a priest, okay? In which case...
You're seen as holy.
All right, yeah. So part of what Paul's challenging here is this idea that there is one elevated state above another. And he's saying, actually, it's a lot more complicated than that. So in this passage tonight, he's advocating for marriage in response to this idea that singleness or celibacy is actually more holy than marriage. In 2 weeks, we'll look at when he takes the opposite approach. And he says, well, actually, singleness is really valuable too. So he's really arguing there's great value in both states. Just matters what God calls you to. That's his kind of point. So he begins by really suggesting that sex is good. If you want to have sex, you should have it in marriage. All right? Then he goes on to speak about how that works out in marriage. So this is verses 3-5. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights. Love that word, right? And likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer, but then come together again, so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So, Paul is suggesting that within marriage, there's this relationship between husband and wife where each of them owe each other something in turn. You know those credit card offers where they like send you a thing and it's like, transfer your balances and you can have like 6 months no interest. You know what I'm talking about? Have you ever wanted to like just keep doing that? Or like get two and like keep transferring them and you set up this like infinity cycle and like you never have to pay? Okay, I have. Maybe you haven't. I think it's probably illegal, so you probably shouldn't. But that was the best illustration I could have of this, where you have two parties that like each owe each other something, but it creates this like circle of what I would describe as mutuality. All right, and I think that's what he's getting at here, that the husband and wife each owe each other something, but it creates this interdependence, this sense of being mutual with each other. And he's saying that both the husband and the wife kind of have rights to each other's bodies. And he says the husband should fulfill his conjugal duty for the wife likewise. He says don't deprive each other, that if you're married, you should be having sex. That's part of his point. Now, if you are married and your spouse doesn't want to have sex at the moment, quoting 1 Corinthians 7:5, may or may not work out. Not that I speak from experience, but it's usually not a good idea to quote 1 Corinthians in that type of situation. Moving on. And again, what he's doing here is he's contradicting the social conventions of the day. All right? So within their society, it was customary for the man to be the head of the household and to be seen as the essentially the owner of all that's within his household, including his wife, right? And so for Paul to say what he starts out with in verse 4, for the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Everybody would be going, yeah, exactly. That's the way it works. The wife does not have authority over her body, the husband does. And then he goes on and says, likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. And everybody would be going, what? No, that's not how it works. It works the first way, not the second way. And plus, how can it work both ways, right? How can two people have authority over each other? Isn't authority like here and there? And so if If I'm here and this person's there, but they're there, like, that doesn't work, right? But that's the point. That's the system that Paul is creating of a mutual authority over each other, of this partnership, of this collaboration. And it doesn't make sense according to the world, but this is what following Christ does. This is what it means to be a Jesus follower, that the rules of the world, they don't apply. They break down. And remember when we started 1 Corinthians, we had this notion of the wisdom of God being something that was foolishness for the world. And here's an example. Well, how can two people each have authority over each other? That's foolishness. That doesn't make sense. Unless you both worship a God who grants you that and who calls you to live together and love each other and sacrifice for each other. So in thinking about this, in thinking about this idea of marriage as mutual and marriage as something that breaks the social conventions of the day, what do you think the social conventions of our day are? What conventions does our world suggest for marriage or sex within marriage that maybe need to be broken? What are some thoughts?
A lot of women use sex as sort of like a controlling thing.
Okay.
We can incentivize activity.
Okay.
So maybe that's not great.
Maybe that's not. Yeah. Sex can be a powerful form of control over another person. Absolutely. Other thoughts?
I think there's also this idea that sex is supposed to be risky and exciting, so if you get into a marriage, then you run the risk of being bored for the rest of your life or being stuck in something that's suddenly very mundane and not exciting.
That's great, yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, all the sex that we are exposed to through media or culture is this kind of like, yeah, risky, exciting. It's like in strange places, or it's like two people who ought not to be having sex, right? There's this element of like something. And so to have sex with the same person for long periods of time for the rest of your life seems like, well, that's not what sex is supposed to be. It's a great point. Right. Yeah, within marriage, sex is like on demand, right? And yet, it's not. That's a good point.
Sometimes society tells us that sex is one of, you know, a most important part of a marriage, like your marriage can break up if you don't have good sex.
Yeah.
But marriage, maybe that's true.
Okay.
But I don't think that's...
I would agree, yeah. And people say, well, you know, how could you get married without having sex? Like, what if you're not sexually compatible, right? Or don't you have to, like, try it out before you get married? What if you don't like it with each other? What if, like, you don't work together? And it's, I mean, it's kind of like, well, it's a man and a woman, and, like, it works. Like, it's not too complicated, right?
What if you
just brought the money to the house? They say you got to try out the shoes before you buy them.
That's probably true with shoes. Yeah.
There's also another saying that I'd rather drive a new car than one that has 20,000 miles on it.
There you go. Though I have bought shoes online and it's worked out quite well. So. Maybe that's something that needs to be changed. Very good. One thing I would suggest is even the value of the marriage relationship, I think in our culture, you get married and there is this, you know, I've realized that almost every love story you read or see or hear about has to do with finding love, right? It's the meeting, it's the falling in love, it's the getting married, and like the wedding is always the end of the movie, right? And I've realized, like, well, great, I fell in love and I married her. Like, now what? Right? And I think that's one of the things that can actually drive affairs, because it's like, well, if the exciting thing is falling in love, and I've fallen in love in my 20s and gotten married, like, so I don't get to fall in love anymore? Like, that part of my life, the part that our culture talks about over and over again, is over, and that you just kind of live with this marriage. And there's this idea then that if you, you know, you get married and you have kids, and kind of like, well, that romance or that wooing or that excitement, that's kind of childish stuff, and now you get down to the real business of life, and you work hard at your job so you can retire, and you know, and it's like, how many people do you know that you know, your colleagues or your coworkers that say, oh, I'm going to take my spouse out on a date tonight, or I'm going to go do this fun thing, you know? The idea of, like, the marriage, the wedding relationship itself is actually something still that can be exciting and can be fun, and that you prioritize and that you don't do other things, and so you can enjoy each other. Like, that's something that is really different in our culture. And I think that would make statements that, hey, like, my marriage, even after 15 years, it's still, I still go out on dates with my wife and I look forward to it. And I, like, that's what's fun. And yet that's pretty different in our culture. This issue of mutuality is a tricky one. It is hard to figure out what does it look like to care for each other, to both owe each other something and to live that out in day-to-day life. But that's really the call of what it means to be married, I think, is to do that. And when you start doing that, then you walk into this place of learning to love another person, learning to be loved, to receive and give love, and it's a powerful thing. So because of that, I want to go to Ephesians 5 just to think a little more about this idea of what really happens in marriage, how the Bible treats it. So the purpose of 1 Corinthians, really what Paul is dealing with is the issue of sexuality, and he kind of touches on marriage to say this is where marriage, this is where sex ought to be inhabited. But I want to expand on this idea of mutuality with 2 points from Ephesians 5. And there is a lot here. There's a lot that could be said, but I want to pull out 2 things from verses 31 to 33. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is profound, and I am saying that it refers to Christ and the church. However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. Now, 2 big points. First of all, this verse 32, this mystery is profound, and I am saying that it refers to Christ and the church. This is one of those statements that Paul pulls out of nowhere. And if you're reading along, he's talking about husbands and wives and how they're to treat each other. And then he says, oh, by the way, I'm talking about Christ and the church. And if you've been reading along, you go, no, you weren't. That's not what you were saying. So what do you mean, oh, by the way, I'm talking about Christ and the church? And he does this, I think, to introduce this idea that part of what God has done in giving us marriage is to give us this unique relationship that, like no other experience, connects us to the nature and person of God. Now, I think this is true for relationships in general. I'm actually going to make a similar point in a few weeks out of 1 Thessalonians about friendship. But because of the intensity of the marriage relationship, it illustrates this to a significant degree. So let's say you traveled back to, I don't know, I just saw the movie Back to the Future recently. So let's say you travel back to, 1955, I think. Isn't that where they went back to? And let's say that you really wanted to explain to somebody what an iPhone was. How would you do it? It's magical. It's magical, all right? How else? Right? It's like a horse, but better. All right. So far, this person has a really no clue what an iPhone is. But let's keep going. Maybe we can improve upon this.
You can communicate with anybody in the world at any time. This handheld device.
Great. I like that. You can communicate with anybody anywhere in the world with his handheld device. Okay, great. Anything else?
Information at your fingertips.
Information at your fingertips. All right. What?
Could you play games for money?
Play games for money?
It's how I watch cat videos online.
How I watch cat videos, okay.
What's online?
Yeah, exactly. What's online? What's the internet? What analogies could you use? How could you help them understand online, the internet? It's like a what?
A map that tells you where to go.
A map that tells you where to go. Okay, I like that. Like a genie map, right? Did you have one?
Oh, no. It's like a phone.
It's a phone with no cord. Okay? That's a good start.
Andrew's whispering that it's a cheap
Android. It's a cheap Android. All right. All right. Getting some rumbles here. Forget our small groups tonight. We're going to have iPhones over here. Yeah. You're trying to get a group of people, you're trying to get someone to understand something that they don't have any experience with, right? So let's say that you're God. You've played this game a lot, I'm sure. And you're a Trinity, right? You are the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, okay? And so you like exist in relationship with yourself, right? And let's say you create somebody and you're like, boy, I really want them to know how cool it is to be a Trinity. What do? You give them an iPhone, right?
give them a relationship,
right? Give them this like deep relationship where the two become one, right? And God's part of that, and now there's like three that are connected in some way, right? And so this is what Paul's saying, that marriage, the purpose of all of this, and the purpose, I think, of sex as well, is somehow to create this intimate connection that God himself experiences. It's no mistake, I think, that sex is very much a part of a lot of religious life. Some religions restrict sex a lot and have a lot of rules and have a lot of ethics around sexuality. I would put following Jesus in that category. Some religions go the other route, right? We went to India several years ago and we ministered to temple prostitutes that worked at a temple where people would come to worship and have sex with them as part of their worship. And so this isn't like something that just happened 2,000 years ago, that this is real. Like, there's religions that involve sexuality as an expression of religion. Why? Because there's an awareness that what's happening there, this intimacy, this oneness, this connection, is something deeper than just what we can understand. There's something spiritual about it. There's something almost divine. There's some quality to it. And that, I think, is what Paul's saying, that when you're talking about a man and a woman, when you're talking about this marriage thing, you're talking somehow about God at the same time. So then he concludes his discussion about men and women by saying, let each of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. So he gives different instructions to husbands and to wives. He says to husbands, you ought to love your wife. And he says to wives that you ought to respect your husband. Which of course means that husbands don't have to respect their wives, right? And wives don't have to love their husbands. Aha, right. No, of course it doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean that this is a one-way street. It just means that here's some language. Here's some tools for thinking how it's different to love a man than it is to love a woman. So, true or false? Men and women are different.
True.
That one's not a trick. That one, I think, is true. The funny thing about that statement is almost everybody will agree with that statement. But as soon as you start trying to describe how men and women are different, you're going to get in trouble, right? You can recognize that, yes, I mean, I've had female children and male children, and they are different as kids. You've worked with women and men, all of you, and they are different. You've had friends, and you can say, yes, men and women are different. But as soon as you start trying to describe how they're different, you're just going to get in trouble, right? And I think that's because we have a hard time conceptualizing difference that isn't hierarchical, that doesn't place a value on difference, right? If there's iPhones and Androids, one of them's got to be better, right? They can't just be different. One of them has to be better. I mean, how can two things be different without one of them being better than the other? That's just the way we think. That's wired into us, that we have this competitive nature. And so to say that men and women are different, and here's how they're different, as soon as you start labeling differences, you're going to say, well, this is obviously better than that, or this is obviously whatever. And yet, I think what Paul is saying is that men and women are different, and so the way a husband relates to a wife ought to be different than the way a wife relates to a husband. And I believe he's not saying that one is above the other, or one is better than the other, or one is worse than the other. He's just saying love looks different if you're loving a woman or if you're loving a man, because they're different. Now, love looks different in general. I think he gives this language for generalities, but then what's really important is the specifics, because if you're going to get married, you're not going to marry women, or you're not going to marry men. You're going to marry a woman, an a man, right? A specific individual. And so, delete that part, right? So the question then is, what does it look like to love this person, right? How do I love this person? And that becomes the journey. And how does that person love me? And that becomes the journey of marriage. And it's going to look different because you're different genders. It's going to look different because you're different personalities. It's going to look different than your friends, because you're different personalities than your friends. The point here is love looks different for different people. And that's what makes mutuality hard sometimes, because my tendency is going to be to love this person the way I'd like to be loved, right? And yet, that's not how they want to be loved. They want to be loved a different way. So I need to learn how to love this other person in the way that she wants to be loved. And she needs to learn to love me in the way that I want to be loved, not the way that comes naturally. So this mutuality and this difference kind of all works together. All right, so we're going to take some time to discuss this. But the big ideas here are that sex is this gift. It can be dangerous. Can be exciting, it can be misused, and we've talked the last couple weeks about how we can think well about our sexuality. And now Paul's given us this very clear instruction of here's the context, here's the framework where sex is meant to be enjoyed. He's given us some guidelines, this idea of mutuality. He's suggested in Ephesians that sex and marriage has to do with our spiritual lives. It connects us with God in some deep way. And that as we learn to love each other, part of the challenge is learning to love somebody different and learning to receive love from someone that's different from us. Just to give a bit of a preview of where we're going, next week we're going to have a panel on marriage. So we'll have three couples here that will share a little bit about their story, and then most of the time will just be Q&A from you guys talking about marriage. 2 weeks from now, we're going to look at 1 Corinthians 7, the latter part of it, where Paul talks about singleness. And so we'll have a teaching on how to think about singleness. And then the week after that, we'll have a panel on singleness. And we'll hear from a couple people who are single, a couple people who have been single, and kind of think about that topic. And again, we'll have a lot of chance for Q&A. I think that'll mostly get us through till Easter, and we'll take a week or so off at Easter, and then we'll come back. And there's a whole slew of new topics after this and the rest of 1 Corinthians. So why don't I pray for us, then we'll break up into our small groups.